Today is Monday, November 1st, 2010. I'm Jess Landing.
I'm Claire Eagle, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It's 5:13 and time for a full hour of independent news. In campus news, we will be bringing you a story on the increase in student-organized conferences at UBCs and the challenges that organizers face. We also will be bringing you coverage of Thrive UBC, a week-long campaign to draw awareness to mental health issues. And in local news, we have coverage of a panel discussion UBC recently held on density in the city.
And today, we will bring you Megan Tricotto's weekly City Hall update, which you can hear every Monday on News 101. And we will hear from Colleen Kimmett in our weekly feature with the online news magazine, thetie.ca.
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Aviation authorities in Germany halted all inbound passenger flights from Yemen today. This follows a cancellation of air freight shipments over the weekend in response to mail bombs intercepted on Friday. Forensic testing on the devices indicates they might have been detonated while in transit. Also today, the UK banned all shipments of freight from Somalia and Yemen. The United States Postal Service is not allowing mail sent from Yemen to enter the country. They join UPS and FedEx in the embargo. As aviation authorities and security officials around the world scrutinize packages, authorities in Yemen continue to search for a woman believed to have mailed the packages in Sana'a. Thousands there celebrated today after a computer science student detained Friday in connection with the bombs was released. Hanan al-Samawi and her mother were freed when investigators determined she was the victim of identity theft. Brazilian voters have elected their first female president. Workers' Party candidate Dilma Rousseff won just over 56% of yesterday's vote, defeating conservative candidate José Serra. Mike Fox has more from Brazil.
Even before the results were officially announced, Dilma supporters had taken to the streets filling Paulista Avenue in São Paulo. Dilma's victory was a big win for those among Brazil's poor and lower middle classes who have benefited under the Lula administration. Over the last 8 years, more than 20 million Brazilians have emerged from poverty, supported by social programs such as Bolsa Família, which provides a stipend for families as long as their children are in school, and Minha Casa Minha Vida, a program that brings homeownership within reach for poor Brazilians. Dilma has promised to continue and expand Lula's policies. Dilma is an economist who served as energy minister and chief of staff under the Lula government. Dilma, like Lula, has a radical background. In 1970, because of her activism against the dictatorship, she was arrested, jailed, and tortured for nearly 3 years. Nevertheless, most members of the Landless Workers Movement, or MST, don't expect any radical progressive changes. The coalition that carried Dilma to the presidency is composed of over 10 political parties. After victories last month, this coalition also has a solid majority in both the Congress and Senate. Dilma will take office on January 1st. Mike Fox, FSRN, São Leopoldo, Brazil.
An Israeli military court has sentenced a soldier guilty of prisoner abuse and improper weapon use to 5 months in jail. The unidentified soldier was convicted last week for posing for photographs while pointing his gun at the head of a detained Palestinian. The bodies of two Afghan women missing since Friday were found today. One of them, Majabin, founded an NGO called Majuba that provides vocational training to women in Helmand Province. The two women were shot multiple times. No one has yet claimed responsibility for their deaths. In other news from Afghanistan, Taliban fighters took 16 police officers hostage during a brief siege in Ghazni province today. The fighters were quickly repelled by Afghan security forces. The fate of those kidnapped is unclear. And NATO forces fought off what was reportedly an attack on a combat post close to the Pak-Afghan border. Local authorities say NATO forces killed 80 militants. NATO puts the death toll at 30. In India today, civil rights groups and intellectuals are condemning a mob attack on renowned writer and activist Arundhati Roy's house. Hindu nationalist groups are incensed at Roy for her recent comments on independence for Kashmir. Bismillah Gilani reports.
On Sunday morning, dozens of activists from the main opposition, Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP's women's organization, barged into Arundhati Roy's house in New Delhi, shouting slogans against her and vandalizing property. The attack came 2 days after the government decided not to take any legal action against Roy for her recent remarks supporting independence for Kashmir. The BJP has been demanding Roy's arrest on sedition charges. A day after the attack, condemnation statements are pouring in from across the country. Reacting to the incident, Roy said the right-wing groups are using her to distract attention from some of their senior members who are facing charges relating to a bomb blast at a Muslim shrine. Roy also blamed a section of the mainstream media for inciting mob anger against her, noting that mobile broadcasting vans arrived in front of her house even before the attackers did. None of the TV channels, however, broadcast the news. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Evening mass in an Iraqi church turned into mass murder when attackers stormed a Catholic church today. At least 58 people died. A group tied to Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for the attack. International election observers say that yesterday's poll in the Côte d'Ivoire was peaceful and credible. After a decade of delays, the election was the first since the 2002 civil war in the West African nation. Tension persists, however, about who qualifies for citizenship and voting rights in a country where one-fifth of the population are migrant workers from other nations. Many fear post-electoral violence when results are released on Wednesday. Incumbent President Laurent Gbagbo was challenged by 13 candidates, including opposition leader Alassane Ouattara and former President Henri Bédi. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Jess Landing. We now go to News 101's Andrew Longhurst and the TIE's Colleen Kimmett.
Thank you, Jess. And that's right, Colleen Kimmett from the online news magazine, thetie.ca, joins me on the line. She recently published more articles on the food security series she's been working on. And first of all, Colleen, thanks again for joining us on the show.
You're welcome.
So I want to first ask you about one of your first articles that you published on the 28th, How Mennonites Are Modernizing a Local Food Economy. Can you tell me a little bit more about this, and specifically you talk about the Elmira Produce Auction Cooperative in Ontario. So maybe you can touch on just some of the general points that you cover and issues you cover in the article, and talk about that initiative.
Sure. Well, this region is home to a large community of Old Order Mennonites. So these are people who generally don't use technology, computers, internet, vehicles. They farm traditionally. They use horses and buggies to get around. They have a traditional dress. Generally, it's about being very a plain, simple lifestyle. Many of them are farmers, and in 2004, many were hit hard by the mad cow or BSE crisis. There was a trade ban on Canadian beef, and farmers lost a lot of money. So they were looking to diversify, and they decided that they needed a way to better market fruits and vegetables. So they created the produce auction, which is essentially a big warehouse just outside the town of Elmira, which is about 45 minutes from Waterloo. And this is a place where three times a week farmers bring their produce, and buyers from all over the county and region come to buy produce. It's an auction format, so there's an auctioneer, you know, with a microphone, and he goes from lot to lot, and the highest bidder takes all. And the advantage of this is that buyers, it's like one-stop shopping for grocery stores, for retail markets that otherwise wouldn't have the time to deal with these small farmers, these small individual farmers. This is a place where they can go and have access to a whole lot and a wide variety of produce in one place.
Now, obviously, the issue of fair prices is something that a lot of smaller-scale farmers face, and especially smaller-scale organic farms. Is this a way to address that issue, or is there more work to be done?
Well, I think that, certainly the auction tries to promote and foster a fair price for all. However, one of the founders of the auction last year left to create his own wholesale business. It's a different model where the price is set, and he sends out a newsletter to all of his buyers at the beginning of the week saying, we have spinach for $1.99 a pound and strawberries for $3 a pound or whatever, and then they place their orders. So it takes the takes the surprise element of the auction out of the equation, because he knows exactly what price his products will fetch. And he pointed out that one of the reasons he didn't feel the auction model was working for him was because if there happens to be, if a lot of people show up at auction day with apples, that's going to drive the price of apples down. So it's not a perfect model, but I think this cooperative effort to sort of pool the resources of smaller farmers to try and attract larger retail buyers is certainly something that could be replicated.
Interesting. And I now want to talk about another article, part of the series. It's titled The Little Food Connector That Could. Tell me a bit about this article, and specifically about a new cooperative venture called the Home Grow In Market Collective, which I'm quite curious about, and you touch on, which is sort of what largely your article is based around.
Yeah, so the Home Grow In is a little shop on the corner of Columbia and 18th in Vancouver. It was started by a woman named Deb Reynolds, who used to be an organic farmer and who used to drive every day from Coston to Vancouver, about 5 hours each way, to sell her produce at farmers markets. And the advantage for her was that she could get a better price at the farmers market. The disadvantage, of course, was that she was doing a lot of driving. It was a lot of work. And so she started this market in order to sell strictly made in BC food and food products to an urban market, so that farmers wouldn't have to rely strictly on farmers markets, so that there'd be a permanent place where people could find BC products. And that's expanded now into a store where her suppliers have actually helped pitch in for the store space and for staff, so that they can have a freezer, for example, of local pork products available downtown in an urban market all of the time. And it's proving to be successful so far. She's also got a co-op buying program that has spun out of the store. It's essentially like a community-supported agriculture program where members sign up for shares of a farmer's harvest at the beginning of the year, and then they come to her store to pick up their weekly produce boxes throughout the season.
Interesting. Well, now this concludes your work on this series. Is that right, Colleen?
No, we've got more coming.
Oh, okay.
They'll be running, I think, 10 in total. So we'll be running more every Thursday and Friday over the next few weeks.
Great. Well, we're definitely looking forward for more coverage of food security. And as always, thank you again for joining us on the show.
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay, thanks again.
Bye.
Bye. And that was Colleen Kimmett from the online news magazine, thetaiyi.ca. And as always, I want to thank Colleen and our good friends at thetaiyi.ca. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. It's now time for your News 101 headlines. For that, we go to Jess Landing and Claire Eagle.
I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Claire Eagle.
In campus news, UBC has received an A-minus grade from the Cambridge-based Sustainable Endowments Institute, which recently released its annual Green Report Card. The report uses surveys and open research to create a grade scale for hundreds of colleges and universities in the United States and Canada. Schools are ranked on administration, commitment to emissions reduction, food and recycling, green building, student involvement, and transportation. Some critics argue that the report is not reliable as it is based upon surveys that the schools fill out themselves. Regardless, the report reflects a growth in sustainable initiatives. 58% more schools had a green building initiative than in 2006, while 55% more have established a sustainable committee. Schools that earned A's included Brown and Yale Universities, Oberlin College, and the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Other A-minus schools included Colorado College and the Georgia Institute of Technology. The report can be read online at www.ca.greenreportcard.com.
In international news, UBC professor and international crime expert James Stewart presented a document at The Hague this week arguing that corporations that exploit war-torn countries for natural resources should be charged with war crimes. The conference, titled Corporate War Crimes, included international attendees from the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. Stewart asserted that when firms obtain natural resources, such as diamonds, tin, and even timber from war zones, money for weapons purchasing is generated by the resource controllers, which in turn can finance human rights abuses by rebel groups or oppressive regimes. Following the Second World War, many firms were charged with collaboration for allowing German troops in Nazi-occupied regions access to resources. However, there have been no cases of this sort since then. Stewart hopes that his paper can be treated as a manual, linking current law and corporate responsibility, thereby encouraging courts to prosecute companies that violate these.
In campus news, the animal rights advocacy group Stop UBC Animal Research Now is campaigning for greater transparency in the university's animal research process. According to its website, the group contends that the university has been, quote, less than forthcoming about its animal research, end quote. They want more information on UBC's animal research made available to the public. This includes video documentation of animal experiments, the university's animal use protocol, veterinary reports, and the Canadian Council on Animal Care's assessment of the university. In a mass email to UBC staff, faculty, and students, Dr. John Hepburn, Vice President of Research and International, responded to the campaign. He contends that groups such as STOP are using shock tactics and misleading information, and that the university is in compliance with all federal laws and Canadian Council for Animal Care regulations. The University of British Columbia is the second largest biomedical research campus in the country, and much of the documentation STOP wants released is the intellectual property of individual researchers.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
A video of the incident was posted on YouTube.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by saveournet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Jess Landing. You're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. The current time is 5:33, and time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we go to Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, Jess. Well, we should see the sun by tomorrow afternoon, but sadly it will be gone by Friday, leaving us with cloudy and wet conditions for the weekend. For tonight, cloudy with a chance of showers, low of 9 degrees overnight. For tomorrow, it will be cloudy with a small chance of showers in the early morning, sunny with cloudy periods in the afternoon. High of 14, low of 9. On Wednesday, mix of sun and cloud with a high of 15 degrees and a low of 6. For Thursday, mix of sun and cloud, high of 15, low of 7 degrees. For Friday, cloudy with showers, high of 12 degrees, low of 9. On Saturday, we're going to start to see rain with a high of 12 degrees, low of 6. And finally for Sunday, rain again with a high of 11 and a low of 7 degrees. Currently it is 13 degrees and cloudy at YVR. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 11 degrees and a low of 4. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thanks as always to Daniel Casanova in the Storm Club of UBC for bringing us that forecast. And now, we bring you a report on student-organized conferences at UBC, brought to you by reporter Claire Eagle.
Student life has always been about more than just the academics, and UBC is no exception. With hundreds of clubs, student societies, and associations on campus, there is no shortage of extracurricular activities available for students. Recently, however, there's been a growth in the number of student-focused and often student-led conferences on campus, and the benefits of these go both ways. One participant at CLASS, or the Conference on Learning and Academic Student Success, which took place on October 13th, had this to say.
Well, I took two concurrent learning sessions, and I learned a lot about studying and time management, and one of my biggest problems is focusing on studying, and I feel like I could have a better handle on it.
Other participants saw learning opportunities that reached far beyond their faculty.
I guess I've learned how important networking is. I'm in commerce in first year, and I got kind of freaked out by all the numbers and statistics. But it was great to see that there is a more social side to the business world, and how that can really apply to all fields in your life.
These benefits do go both ways to positively affect their organizers, as Ethan Gold, organizer of the upcoming Canadian Investing Conference, learned.
I guess the hardest thing has been really realizing that you're managing a team of your peers, and they do look up to you whether or not, you know, they're older than you or not, and they don't look up to you in the sense of you personally. I guess they do, but at the same time, they respect what you're going through to make this thing work, and everyone works together as a team unit, and when the ball is rolling, it's a lot of fun, and it's really rewarding.
However, these efforts do not come without their difficulties.
We've gone through some controversy, and it's been pretty hard. I actually originally jumped on the team, and I started working on this when I was back in Boston all summer. So my main difficulty was helping organize this thing all the way across the continent. And then I'd say the second biggest thing was, I guess, after that, was jumping back into it once I arrived here. You know, getting, you know, I wasn't really that involved with the CUS last year. I was actually very ill. So to really show my face around the CUS, the dean's office, student body, things like that, it took a lot of effort. It's taken a lot of time out of my schedule. I've devoted probably 70 to 80% of my whole day to Civic 24/7 for the last, you know, last probably 2 months.
Jahani Hassan, co-president of the UBC Amnesty International Club, feels as though faculty involvement would help ease the burden of promotions and discussion from the shoulders of the organizers alone.
But although I think especially something like Amnesty would perhaps have to be promoted also by professors who teach something that is related, and that would bring teachers, that would bring the attention of the students to see that there is conferences out there. So if professors should, you know, say that these conferences or these organizations are important for a student life, students are going to, like, you know, some light bulb's going to light in their head and go, oh, yeah, maybe I should go ahead and look for them, so something like that.
Regardless of the stresses that these conferences may incur, it goes without saying that student-led conferences are a growing trend that reaps only benefits in the long run. As Ivy Wan, part of the Chasing Sustainability Conference team, says,
I think they're very important because it's learning that you don't get from a textbook, and it's all these skills that you get to connect with different years and your faculty, and you learn all these skills of planning and logistics that you can't get just from studying.
For CITR News, I'm Claire Eagle.
Thank you, Claire. We now go to Megan Turcato's weekly City Hall update, which you will hear every Monday here on News 101.
City Hall. This is a song for the people in the streets and the people, City Hall.
City Hall makes a lot of little decisions that affect us all in big ways. This segment asks, what happened at City Hall this week? This week, there's good news for all the friends of the farm out there. UBC has submitted to the city its new land use plan, which calls for the farm zoning to change from future housing reserve to green academic. This means the farm is no longer slated to become a housing development. However, there is no mention of the size of the new academic green space, only that the rezoning represents the loss of 300,000 square meters of possible residential floor space. So it remains unclear if the school intends to retain all of the farm's current 24 acres for agriculture. Just because condos aren't going up on the farm doesn't mean there won't be more housing on campus. UBC told the city this week that its ultimate goal is to have 50% of students living on campus in 10 years. The school plans to start right away with 500 new beds ready for students next fall. That's an increase in the number of resident spots of more than 20%. A Norquay Village Advisory Committee has recommended the council consider installing a bike lane on Kingsway. Norquay Village is the name the city has given to the area south of Nanaimo and 29th Avenue SkyTrain stations. The city wants to revitalize the area as a shopping district for the neighborhood. To aid in this initiative, the Bicycle Advisory Committee is calling on the city to look into a separated bike lane on Kingsway. The committee also raised concerns about the link between Duchess and 34th Avenue, demanding that at the very least a painted bike lane be installed. If you have comments or questions about the Norquay Village proposal, you can contact the city by phone at 604-871-6964 or email at norquayvillage@vancouver.ca. Vancouver's street soccer team beat out other teams from across the country this year to represent Canada at the annual Homeless World Cup. This year's games, held in Rio, Brazil, attracted teams from 64 nations with the aim of reducing the stigma of homelessness and empowering the unlikely players to take positive steps in their lives. Mayor Gregor Robertson will honor the team this week at Council. But earlier this month, Robertson declared October 11th Vancouver Street Soccer Day in honor of the team's effort at the Homeless World Cup, where they won an award for most sportsmanlike conduct. That was your City Hall update for this week. I'm Megan Turcato.
Thanks to Megan Turcato for bringing us that report.
It's now time for a special report on density in Vancouver from News 101 reporter Iqbal Ahmed.
The subject for tonight's panel is eco-density. Eco-density is a form of urban planning which aims to make more sustainable, affordable, and ecologically friendly housing in Vancouver.
Eco-density, deft or dense, is the subject area that we're looking at. And if I just ask you to all think of it, Vancouver, the greenest city in the world. Sounds great until you start to think about the reality of it. More people living closer together. That actually, though, it means more people living closer together. And therein lies a big problem for a city that is used to having 70% of its population living in single-family dwellings, with a yard and a front yard and street access and all the things that people have been used to having. Now suddenly we're thinking about a city where we're all living much closer together in much more developed sections of the city. We start to think about what all of that means. We start to peel away what eco-density is actually all about. Some people see in this possibilities of new ways of living and new ways of having an urban existence. And some people see strictly politics. Some people see money. Some people see green space.
The panel began by asking Maga Sandel, UBC professor of urban design, what he thought eco-density really meant and what it did not mean.
I think that eco-density is an absolutely laudable goal. It really showed tremendous courage and leadership at a time where planning, especially around North America, has been really thirsty for that kind of forward and visionary thinking that really attempted to tackle some of the deep challenges of climate change and peak oil, and to really, as a community, take a bit of global responsibility in responding and sharing some of our incredible resources that we have, the bounty that we have in this part of the world, and having a response, an example to set for the world. When this first happened, I got congratulatory emails from colleagues around the country as though I had anything to do with it. But just by virtue of living here, I was congratulated that this city was taking on such leadership. I'm sorry to say that the development of this idea, I think fell far short of expectations. The development of the idea has been very poor, and as a result, eco-density is where it is at today. A very ambiguous project, if a project at all. It's not clear whether it's still an ongoing directive at the city of Vancouver, and has perhaps even undermined some of the leadership that Vancouver has shown over the last couple of decades in really showcasing examples of density. So great idea, poorly executed. I'll start with that. Thank you.
The next speaker was Adele Weider, architectural writer and critic, who came and spoke about her thoughts on eco-density and how it's progressed over the years.
Hello. Well, I think increasing density in the city of Vancouver and other metropolitan areas, it's a good thing and it's a necessary thing, but it doesn't really matter what we on the panel or anyone in this room really thinks. What matters is that it's going to happen no matter what we do or think, unless we want the city to turn into the Principality of Monaco. So the question is it going to happen in a good way or a bad way? So my thoughts on eco-density is there's sort of four main concerns about the way it's rolled out in the last decade, and they're all interconnected. And the first is it suffers from the tyranny of democracy. This isn't the fault of any one politician or party. It's just that because we live in this tyranny of democracy where everyone has to jockey for position and popularity, you have the different politicians trying to take credit for who invented it first, who's doing it better, and It's actually been around for, I think, 6,426 years, and it just seems like it happened in the last 10 years. It used to be called survival density, and it's just now we have a catchy name, which is sort of the second concern, is that I think it happens to suffer from an image problem. And the name was good to sort of get people talking about it and thinking about it. Eco-density, it's like a brand, but I think now people look at a name like that the way we look at NutraSweet or Vitamin Water. So this is corporate branding, you know. It's because it's called eco-density, is it really good for us? And are you trying to shove something down our throat? Are you trying to sell us something? So I think part of what I perceive to be a backlash is because people feel it's being sold to them, and it should really come more from the ground up. And that's the third point, is that I think there's been some very excellent focus on developers providing carrots and sticks to get developers and architects to make residential projects more dense in exchange for restoring churches, giving money for other amenities, parks. Where are the incentives for the residents? What do you give a Dunbar Street, you know, So you'll subdivide your 50-foot lot, and what do you get out of it? You know, maybe we should have some focus on them. Maybe we should try to convince them, and maybe we should actually give them some financial incentive to subdivide their street. And then the fourth problem, which is sort of sums it all up, is that I think that we're at a stage where it's too quantified and not quite enough emphasis on the qualitative aspects of neighborhoods. Nobody who lives in Paris complains that they can't have a single-family house. I mean, anyone feels quite privileged to live in a city like that where it's all zero-lot properties, but because it's such a great place to live. And if we could do things like, for instance, restore the Delgrauer substation in downtown Vancouver, I think we'd get twice as many people wanting to live there and raise families there. If we got three-bedroom apartments, and if we've got some private outdoor space so that people like me, who raised my kids there for the first 10 years and was forced to move out, then we'd have true eco-density. So that's my hope. Thank you.
And finally, we'll hear from Michael Goldberg, professor at the Sauder School of Business, and hear his thoughts on eco-density and how leadership has failed to make it a reality in the city.
I want to pick up two themes that Adele and Maggie touched on, and really look at leadership and its virtual absence in this issue. It's interesting to me that this is where we're speaking. I hadn't seen this place. The first consulting job I ever did in 1969 was for Marathon Realty, and they had these rail lands here, and they wanted to convert them to high-rise housing. So they asked some of us from UBC to go and do a survey of people in the West End. We did a 1% survey of 32,000 people in the West End, and it turned out, based on that survey, that no chance of building family-oriented housing, because all the people who live in the West End were not allowed to have kids in the buildings. So we realized that the sample idea was good, but you couldn't ask people to imagine a state of affairs that didn't exist at the time. So it's interesting to come full circle and be in a place that is moderately dense. But people who've tried to densify neighborhoods in the 42 years I lived here have always had an uphill slog, despite the fact that the density has been, you know, highly sought after. If you look at Kerrisdale, which would certainly be one of the more resistant places on the face of the earth to change, the multifamily high-rises there are hugely sought after. There's a shortage of them. And it raises an interesting issue when you talk about neighborhood change and stability. Is a neighborhood stable because you have the same buildings? Or is it stable because people can go through their lifestyle, and their life cycle in that neighborhood? Before high-rise apartments were in Kerrisdale, people had to abandon the neighborhood as they became empty nesters and moved to other places. With density and with greater diversity of housing styles in Kerrisdale, now you can have a full life cycle. So this has been an awful area in the city of Vancouver since I got here, and it's characterized by a lack of leadership and very crass politicking. It's fitting that UBC tries to throw some light on this because it's at largely an educational issue. And I think among all the fear that's tossed out about change, there's an awful lot that people can do to embrace density and see. In point of fact, it's a very good thing, and the examples we have and the examples of this in other cities are not to be feared, they're to be embraced.
Thanks for that, Iqbal. We now go to News 101 reporter Andrew Longhurst for a report on Thrive Week happening this week at UBC.
This is Andrew Longhurst for News 101, and I'm in the studio with Suzanne Jolly and Sarah Eden, and they're here to talk a little bit about Thrive UBC, and I want to thank you both for coming into the studio.
Great, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So just first of all, what is Thrive?
Well, Thrive is a whole week of events focused on mental health for students, staff, faculty, and alumni here at UBC, and it's really meant to challenge the stigma of mental health issues and to highlight some of the resources that we do have available.
And so there's a number of events that go on as part of the awareness. Can you tell me a little bit about the events and some of the activities that have been planned for it?
Sure. So we are right now running the Wellness Fair in the Student Union Building Concourse. So it's 2 days, Monday and Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, we have Suicide Awareness Day, where we have a number of films screenings on campus, one in the morning at the First Nations House of Learning, and then one at lunch here in the sub, and then one in the evening in the Vanier residences. And also we kick off a postcard art campaign in the sub that day as well.
And then the wrap-up is on Friday in the First Nations House of Learning, and it should be really good. We started Thrive Today at the kickoff with a lot of drumming, Drum Cafe, 300 African hand drums, and we're ending it with a taiko drumming group, and they're coming to the First Nations House of Learning, and there's going to be free lunch, and should just be a really nice way to keep the spirit of Thrive going throughout the year.
Now, Sarah, you're a student on student representative on the Thrive Committee. What initially motivated you to get involved?
Yeah, well, I started working with Healthy Minds at UBC, which is the student side of the sort of UBC's efforts to raise awareness around mental health issues. And as part of that job, I joined the committee for Thrive just because I thought it sounded like a great initiative to have during the school year. And I was excited about the events from 2009, Thrive Week. And so I just really wanted to be a part of it.
Now, how long has Thrive existed?
This is our second year.
Okay. So definitely you've probably received some feedback and, took in some good information from last year's. After Thrive, what do you hope to see on campus? Is it something that's really measurable and tangible, or is it something that maybe is, I guess, less tangible in a way, but you know, how do you measure that? It's hard to measure mental health, right? It's hard to measure when a lot of stuff often is unreported, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the issues, is there are stigmas around mental health issues, and so people sometimes are not likely to report or go into the clinic or seek counseling. So how do you measure, how do you measure success in that, to that extent?
Certainly. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think part of that is, I guess when I first started thinking about Thrive Week and the sort of what our goals were, I kind of thought it's similar a little bit to how sustainability and that sort of idea of like recycling and all of that, like that's such a thing that most people are really behind on UBC. Like there are, you know, recycling bins everywhere for paper, plastic, and all of that. And I think it's kind of one of those things that you want to encourage people to get behind on, like, on that, on all of those different levels. So that's why it's really important that Thrive is for students, staff, and faculty, that it's not an issue that's just for one person. Just like it's important that we need to look for our earth, you know, to recycle and all of that, but it's important for like every human being, no matter what faculty you're in or what, you know, stage of life you're at, to take care of your body and mind. And so just really, I think you can kind of measure that in some ways just by seeing how the dialogue like on campus is around that, and how that changes a little bit about people maybe not being as shy of talking about I'm really stressed. And you might hear that a little bit more, I think, and not in a way that's just sort of like, I guess, just sort of succumbing to it, like academics equal stress and that's it, but really students feeling that there are options, I guess on the student side of things, that there are options and that there are ways that they can cope with those that they feel happy with.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we look at it from an event standpoint first, and when we're evaluating our success over the week is how many people were actually involved. And we use our Thrive raffle for that measure. Every time you go and participate in an event, you get to enter in the raffle, and there's huge grand prizes. Like how much does that give?
$200
gift certificate to Ticketmaster or
Body Works or Rec
or UBC Rec. There was another one. I can't remember off the top of my head. You'll have to check the website. But so we measure it from an event standpoint that way, but also organizationally. We have our prescription use statistics for staff and faculty, and we have the National College Health Assessment for students, and so we can see how much anxiety or drugs are actually being reported in terms of that, but I know a lot of it is hidden still, and so really we think of organizational health amongst UBC to be, as David Greenier from Stand Up for Mental Health, who came in October, said, you know, one day it should be okay for an employee to walk in and say, you know, not only do I have a headache today, but the voices in my head are really loud today. And we can all sense when that culture starts shifting, and I already know that we've seen that on campus. The dialogue that's happening between staff, faculty, and students, and referrals are happening to the counseling center faster, and all of that. So it's hard to measure in terms of, you know, I can't measure that culture shift, but we'll all know when it's a better place. And we're already going through that process slowly, and that's what Thrive's about, is kind of moving us as a larger community towards a healthier place where we're all better accepted and better connected to resources.
And that was Andrew Longhurst speaking to Thrive UBC organizers who organized a week-long awareness campaign on mental health happening this week at UBC.
And that's our program for November 1st, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Jess Landing.
Today's show was produced by Iqbal Ahmed and Andrew Longhurst. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track at 6 p.m., right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.